The 1960 election campaign is drawing to a close, and I believe that we all of us feel relieved. It has been a very long campaign, much too long. With modern means of communication, which are available to the candidates, television and radio, when every section of the country can be reached almost instantaneously, and when scores of millions of people can listen in and do listen in on the same address and watch the speakers as if they were present in their own homes, campaign that lasts a few months becomes repetitious and tedious and boring. Prolonged campaigns do not help to clarify issues. There are, after all, only a limited number of vital issues in any campaign. And once you have argued them as effectively as you can, you are through. And thereafter, you are only repeating yourself. And in order to hold the interest of the electorate, the listeners, you find yourself compelled to resort to sensational utterances, to free-swinging charges, to abuse, and personal slurs. And from acting and talking as a statesman, you are forced to stoop to the role of the barker and the huckster. Perhaps we ought to take a leaf out of the political experiences of some other countries, Great Britain, for example, and greatly shorten the campaign time, say to 10 days or 2 weeks. I believe that both voters and candidates would be grateful for such a change. Months of electioneering without a coffee break is just too long. There has been an unusual amount of synthetic showmanship in this campaign. Who can draw the biggest crowds seemed to have been the chief concern of both parties. Political rallies are cunningly contrived and organized so as to bring the candidate at the exact auspicious time and the exact place. And the cohorts are marshaled to ensure the biggest crowds in order to demonstrate, I suppose, the particular candidate is truly the choice of the vast majority of the people, and that you might just as well vote for him if you do not wish to waste your vote. Now, there may be good showmanship psychology in all this, but after all, one does not, or one should not, vote for a candidate as one bets on a horse. We bet on a horse to win. We vote for a candidate because we believe that he should win, because he represents our political convictions, regardless of whether he might or might not win. There has been a novel departure in this campaign a very interesting novel departure, and that was the series of TV debates which were held between the candidates. And they were helpful insofar as they brought to the tens of millions who listened in a clearer idea of the issues involved and what the candidates and their parties intended to do about them. But I, for one, could not help to ask myself, as I watched and listened in on these debates, and they were very skillful debates, in many ways remarkable debates and debaters, I could not help asking myself, shall we in the future have to nominate for the office of the President of the United States only clever and skillful debaters? Shall the office go to the one who is quickest at repartee, or who could express himself at the spur of the tense moment without falter and hesitation on the most involved and momentous issues confronting our country? Is this the true test of ability or statesmanship? Or perhaps is the sober second thought that is all important in men who hold the destiny of our country in their hands? Someone has quite properly asked how George Washington would have fared in such a debate. A man of slow and deliberate thought, how would Jefferson have fared? Jefferson, who was not facile in public utterances. Or Wilson, who took time to analyze and qualify and elaborate. Nor, for that matter, were most of our presidents, or a goodly number of them, including Abraham Lincoln, very photogenic. Some issues were given prominence in this campaign, which, in my judgment, did not belong there. This was the case with the offshore islands of Quemoy and Matsu. It was an issue, unfortunately, dragged into this campaign, did not belong there. Neither China nor the United States had raised the issue at this time. It was not on the active agenda, as it were. And certainly a subject so delicate and involved is not a proper topic for campaign heat and controversy. Nor was the Cuba issue a proper theme in this campaign. There were mistakes made in Cuba, but they do not date from the present administration only. They go far back, a long time. And both Republicans and Democratic administrations were involved. And there will be no easy solution for what has developed in Cuba. And we are committed by treaties with our Latin American neighbors not to take unilateral action in relation to Cuba or to any other Latin American state. Nor would it be wise to take unilateral action. We were pleased, I was pleased, when Senator Kennedy retreated from his early position when he called for forthright and immediate action tantamount to an intervention in Cuba, actively backing all anti-Castro elements there and helping to overthrow that regime. It was an issue which did not belong in the campaign. On the subject of America's military strength, that is, whether Russia is the leading military power in the world today or the United States, I, as a layman, and the millions of American citizens who are also laymen and uninformed in such matters, are unable to pass any judgment. I, for one, am prepared to accept the assurance of the President of the United States, himself a military man, who was chief of the victorious Allied forces in the last war, to whom all the data of our military position is available as a matter of course. I was prepared to accept his assurance, and I have no choice but to accept his assurance that the United States is at the peak of its military strength, as in, and is in a ready position to deter any aggressor. But I am compelled, however, to express my disappointment that both candidates appeared to outdo each other in their call for greater and stronger military equipment for our country, and said so little about disarmament, the most urgent and the most pressing need of our times. Both of them, I'm afraid, spoke as the Pentagon speaks when military budgets are about to be voted in Congress. And both candidates outdid one another in their denunciation of communism, but neither, unfortunately, presented a clear program of how a rational way can be found for living together in the same world, how a program can be worked out, looking to what must be done, and the only thing that should be done, can be done, how a program can be worked out for these two power blocks to live together in the same world, on the same globe. On these two foremost and burning issues of our day, both candidates, I'm afraid, gave us much heat, but little light. On the issue of our prestige abroad, of which much has been made in this campaign, you may recall that I spoke about it briefly 2 weeks ago. I have remained unimpressed by this issue. As a nation, we should be concerned with doing the right at all times, regardless of the swiftly changing ebb and flow of so-called international prestige. The nations whose opinion we are, so to speak, soliciting, and about whom reports and surveys are made from time to time, those nations themselves are not paragons of virtue whose judgments are objective and well-founded and unimpeachable. I should not be concerned of what Lumumba thinks of us or Kasavubu thinks of us, but whether what we are trying to do in the Congo is just and humane, and calculated in the long run to be helpful, and therefore to succeed. And that holds true as regards our relations with all the new and the so-called neutral states of Africa and Asia. We should not be maneuvered. We should not maneuver ourselves into a position where we become dependent upon their applause and their approval. We should be scrupulous in our adherence to a code of high international morality, in keeping with our traditional American principles of justice and fair play, helping whatever we can and to the degree that we can. But we should not worry so much about prestige being slapped on the back at all times. There were other unrelated issues introduced into this campaign. Of the Catholic issue, I will speak in a moment. There was also a Jewish issue, forcibly, and in my mind, entirely unjustified, introduced into the campaign. Vice President Nixon and Ambassador Lodge were charged with anti-Jewish and anti-Israel bias. And as a rabbi and a longtime friend of Israel, I felt constrained to speak up against this gross unfairness. I should like to reread this morning what I actually said, because there have been so many interpretations placed on what I said, so many conflicting headlines about it. Actually, what I said was this, and I assure you it was very carefully said and carefully worded. I was delighted to welcome to our home Ambassador and Mrs. Henry Cabot Lodge on the occasion of their visit to Cleveland. I recalled with pleasure our earlier contacts, especially during the critical years prior to the establishment of the State of Israel, when I frequently turned to Mr. Lodge, who was then United States Senator, for counsel, guidance, and political help. And this was always given readily and generously. Ambassador Lodge was always a convinced, warm, and understanding friend of our people's historic hope for the reestablishment of the national Jewish home, as was his distinguished grandfather, who was a pioneer supporter of our movement in the United States. I recall Ambassador Lodge's deep satisfaction when the State of Israel was finally proclaimed, and the eloquent words which he spoke on the occasion of the first anniversary celebration, when I had the privilege of introducing him at a civic rally in Carnegie Hall in New York City. Since those years, Ambassador Lodge has remained a consistent supporter of Israel, its sovereignty, its territorial integrity, its security, and its economic progress. This was the case even during the difficult days of the Suez-Sinai crisis, when, as the spokesman of the United States in the United Nations, he, as a matter of course, represented our government's position, of which many, both here and among our allies, did not fully approve. I am glad to say these things about Ambassador Lodge in order to correct misrepresentations. In the heat and controversy of a political campaign, facts are sometimes distorted, and the helpfulness of loyal friends is sometimes forgotten. Vice President Richard M. Nixon has also been subjected to a mischievous campaign smear. He has been charged with anti-Semitic utterances in his earlier political career. Responsible Jewish bodies have closely investigated these charges. By these bodies, of course, I meant the Anti-Defamation League of the B'nai B'rith and the American Jewish Committee. responsible Jewish bodies have closely investigated these charges and found them to be utterly groundless and false. Mr. Nixon has been a warm friend of Israel. He has advocated continued support to the young state, strong and unceasing efforts to establish freedom of passage through the Suez Canal for Israeli shipping, and an end to all discriminatory actions. The position of the candidates of both political parties on Israel and their attitude towards our people, which in each instance has been friendly and unimpeachable, should not enter into this campaign any more than the religious issue generally. American Jews should vote, and I believe they will vote, without reference to any Jewish angle, which simply does not exist in this campaign. This was the statement, and this was all of it. What interpretation people choose to place upon it, that I'm afraid is unavoidable. I have, of course, my own political preferences, and I shall vote them next Tuesday. But I do not regard it, and never have regarded it, as my function and responsibility as a rabbi to announce my preferences in public or to tell people how they should vote. It is only when I feel that an injustice is being done to a candidate, that is being maligned and slandered in a matter in which I, as a Jew, am involved, and in one in which, with which I am fairly familiar, that I speak up. Well, this is a question of morality. One must be fair, even where one is a strong party man and is very enthusiastic for this or that candidate. One must be fair. I did the same thing once before in 1952 when General Eisenhower was a candidate for the presidency of the United States. In the closing years of that campaign, the issue of the McCarran-Walter immigration law, you may recall, was thrown into the hopper. This was an immigration law which was passed by Congress, by Democrats and Republicans alike. It set quotas for immigrants who wished to come to the United States in any given year. And this law favored the Nordics and discriminated against immigrants from South and Eastern Europe, principally immigrants who would not normally be coming from those countries, Catholics and Jews. President Truman properly and commendably vetoed that bill. Congress overrode his veto. This bill was sponsored by Senator McCarran and Congressman Waters, both Democrats. And the President Truman's veto was overridden both by Democrats and Republicans. General Eisenhower, of course, had nothing to do with the enactment of this law. He was not in Congress at the time, did not hold any political office. But because during his campaign as head of the Republican ticket, he endorsed all Republican candidates for the Senate, among whom were some who had approved of the McCarran bill, President Truman violently attacked General Eisenhower in a letter which he sent to a Jewish body in New York, charged him with accepting the master race theory, implication, charged him with anti-Semitism. This charge was leveled at a man who had broken the might of Hitler and of the Nazi races. President Truman attacked him of moral blindness. And he made the charge at the very time that General Eisenhower was declaring publicly, quote, "We must strike from our statute books any legislation concerning immigration that implies the blasphemy against the democracy, that only certain groups of Europeans are welcome on American shores." At that time, I publicly expressed my feelings of shock that such an attack should be made on General Eisenhower. I said, much is permitted in a campaign, but the attempt by implication to identify a man like General Eisenhower, whose humanity and broad tolerance are known all over the world, with anti-Semitism and anti-Catholicism, is just not permissible, even in the heat of a campaign. Now, some might say that I do these things only when Republicans are involved. I should like to call your attention to an address which I delivered here from this pulpit on May 17th of last year. The subject was "A Catholic President in the White House?" This address was widely reprinted and widely circulated. Our Ohio State Senator Lausche had this address inserted in the congressional record of June 22nd of last year. I wish I had the time to reread to you this entire address, but I must limit myself to just a few lines from it. I said, and I think some of you were here when I spoke on this theme, "I believe that many Catholics in the United States fully accept this position of the separation of church and state. Recently, Senator Kennedy, who came quite close 2 years ago to receiving the nomination for vice president on the Democratic ticket, and who today is talked about as a possible presidential candidate, was questioned on this very issue, and he replied very clearly, and of course he's a Catholic, quote, 'The First Amendment to the Constitution is an infinitely wise one. There can be no question of federal funds being used for support of parochial or private schools. It is unconstitutional under the First Amendment as interpreted by the Supreme Court,' he said. 'I am opposed to the federal government's extending support to sustain any church or its schools. As for such fringe matters as buses and lunches and other services, the issue is primarily social and economic and not religious. Each case must be judged on its merits within the law as interpreted by the courts.'" End of his quote. It is true that Senator Kennedy has been sharply criticized by some editorial writers in the Catholic press for the views which he expressed. It is such criticism which disturbs some non-Catholics in the United States. It raises doubt in their minds, as does the continued criticism of the church hierarchy of our government's failure to aid religious schools. But even those of us who are opposed to federal aid to parochial schools, whether they be Catholic or Protestant or Jewish, and there are Protestant as well as Jewish parochial schools, fail to see what all this has to do with the election of a Catholic to the presidency of the United States. A Catholic president, if elected, takes an oath of office which is prescribed by the Constitution of the United States. This oath of office reads, "I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will to the best of my ability protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. End of quote. Now, what right have we to assume that a Catholic president would be less faithful to his oath, solemnly sworn, than a Protestant president? Numerous Catholics have in the past been elected or appointed to high office in this nation and in every state of the Union, governors, congressmen, senators, many of them elected in states where the majority of the electorate was Protestant, Supreme Court justices, chiefs of the United States Supreme Court, high-ranking military chiefs, and key diplomats. They served with unimpeachable loyalty and integrity. Their religion is in no way caused them to subordinate the interest of their government to the interest of their church. Among the numerous letters which I received after the circulation of this address of 18 months ago was the following. Dear Dr. Silva, I have just read with interest an article in the Cleveland Plain Dealer of May 18th. Your thoughtful and reasoned approach to the question of a Catholic in the White House is both a measure of sustenance and encouragement. I can't help but feel that many Americans are less bigoted and less intolerant today regarding this troublesome matter than they were 30 years ago. Tolerant voices such as yours will surely produce an atmosphere in which all of us can abide peaceably. With every good wish, I remain sincerely, John F. Kennedy. Shortly thereafter, when Senator Kennedy visited Cleveland in connection with his primary campaign, he called upon me in my home. We spent a very pleasant half hour chatting about many things. In this connection, the Catholic issue, I am compelled to say that the recent pastoral letter, which was addressed to the Catholics of Puerto Rico, and read by the priests in all Catholic churches, a pastoral letter signed by three bishops, two of whom were born and educated in the United States, in which letter they ordered all Catholics not to vote for the Popular Democratic Party, as it is called, and stated that those who knowingly violated this injunction would commit sin. And one bishop even intimated the penalty of excommunication. I'm compelled to say that this pastoral letter coming at this time has not made the Catholic position of Senator Kennedy any easier. His own position is very clear and unambiguous. The position of his church is not. The Puerto Ricans are United States citizens, even though they do not vote in a national election. To give voting instructions backed by the authority of the church is, to quote the island governor, who's running on the issue of the separation of church and state, is both anti-American and anti-democratic. And to say that those instructions which were given by the bishops are intended only for Puerto Rico and would never be issued in the United States isn't entirely satisfying. I'm afraid it is begging the question. My advice to all Americans is, on Tuesday next, do not vote as Jews, as Catholics or as Protestants, vote American. Vote your own best interests and the best interest as you see it of your country. To vote against a Catholic just because he is a Catholic is bigotry. And I'm afraid there will be many bigots in this forthcoming election. To vote for a Catholic just because he is a Catholic is also bigotry. And I'm afraid there'll be many such bigots next Tuesday. Before you vote on November 8th, ask yourself the following pertinent questions. Shut out all the din and the clamor now of the campaigns. Think through these questions for yourselves. Do not vote on the basis of the promises that have been made. Before an election, everybody promises pie in the sky. Or as my grandmother used to say, Roginkes mit Mandeln. Naturally. Ask yourself these pertinent questions. One, has our country been generally prosperous during the past several years, during the past administration? Or do you believe that our country would have made and can now make greater and sounder economic progress under a democratic administration? That is a fair question for you to ask yourself. And a basic question. Two, have the rights of labor, the needs of the aged, the sick, the unemployed, have our schools suffered under the past administration? Or would social progress in these directions have been accelerated? And in your judgment, will be accelerated under a democratic administration? That's another fair question for you to ask yourself. Three, in the matter of civil rights, has the past administration made marked progress? Has it gone as far as it should have? And would a democratic administration have done more? And is it likely to do more in the matter of school desegregation in the South, the Negro's rights to vote, and equality of opportunity for the Negro? This is another fair question to ask yourself. Four, has our country been at peace? Has our foreign policy been as imaginative, as clear-sighted, and as adroit as it might have been? And would a democratic administration have acted in a radically different manner with reference, say, towards Russia or China or Berlin or disarmament? This is another fair question for a citizen to ask himself on the eve of an election. And after you've weighed these questions in your mind and their relative importance, then ask yourself who in your judgment of the two candidates is best qualified to carry out the things that you wish to see carried out in our country in the next 4 years. According as you answer these questions, you should vote. On each one of these issues, there may be an honest difference of opinion. And the citizen, that is you, must assume responsibility for his judgment and his decision. Both candidates are good men, intelligent and patriotic, seeking the good of their country. Both believe in the progress for our country. One perhaps would like to reach the new frontiers more rapidly, and the other would like to make progress more slowly. Island Weiler. But both are good men. They may not necessarily be great men, giants of the earth. Both have made mistakes in the past. But no one knows what greatness a man is capable of until he has been challenged by circumstances and summoned to make the great decisions at the critical hour. Mistake to brush both men aside and say, oh, well, don't care for either of them. One of them will be the president of our country. Whomever our people choose next Tuesday, whoever is elected, will be the president of all of us. And we shall all pray that our Heavenly Father will bestow upon him wisdom and counsel and strength to guide our beloved country during the unpredictable years which lie ahead, for their burden, his burden, the burden of the elected chief executive of the United States, the most onerous and difficult office in the world. But his burdens will be very heavy. And so quite calmly and deliberately, and in a spirit of patriotism, think through your position and enter the voting booth on November 8th and vote as a free man. Free man.